You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Thanks for joining us today on a special edition of This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. One of the biggest problems facing businesses today is recruiting and retaining talent. Stephen Kramer is the CEO of Bright Horizons Family Solutions, a publicly traded child care and early education services company headquartered in Watertown. He has some ideas on how to deal with the problem and stopped by our 1061 studios to talk about it.
As most employers are, it is a very, very challenging labor market. And so within the child care market in particular, we for many years have experienced a diminishing pool of talent based on the fact that fewer and fewer individuals are going into early childhood education. So today, only 3% of college graduates are graduating with an early childhood degree, and that compares to many that used to in prior years. So the challenge that we're facing is both a diminishing number of people going into early childhood ed, and then, of course, like everyone, we're facing very low unemployment rates here in Massachusetts and nationally. And so in that context, of course, we're always looking for ways to differentiate ourselves between ourselves and others.
Tell us how you're doing that.
Absolutely. So one of the programs that we launched this year in July was what we're calling our EDAP program. So it's our Early Education Development Assistance Program. And that program is really designed for both attraction as well as retention of early childhood educators. And so individuals that work at Bright Horizons in any one of our 700 child care centers across the country have the ability to go back and get an associate's or bachelor's completely free with no out-of-pocket expenses. And so we're finding that both from a recruitment standpoint as well as from a retention standpoint, it really does hit the mark for our teachers.
You are the first in the country to do this.
We are absolutely the first and the only that is offering a completely free education to their early childhood focused employees.
So far, about 1,000 of your employees have signed up to do this?
Yeah, so we've had 2,000 that have raised their hands, and we have 700 that are already enrolled in an early childhood education program.
We're speaking with Bright Horizons CEO Stephen Kramer about this EDAP program. So where do they take the classes, the employees who sign up for this?
Yeah, so Bright Horizons went out and did a full process to determine the schools that we would want to partner with. So we've curated four schools that our employees have the ability to both get advanced standing for the work that they've done in their past as well as their academic experience. And they're fully online programs, so they work really well for our full-time working learners. And ultimately, they have the ability to get their degrees in 3 to 5 years for an associate's and the same for a bachelor's program.
We have to ask you, how much is this going to cost the company?
Yeah, so this is a large investment for Bright Horizons. It will certainly be in the millions of dollars each year. For Bright Horizons, we don't think about it as an expense. We really think about it as an investment in our people. And it speaks very loudly to the kind of culture that we have at the company.
We're speaking with Stephen Kramer, CEO of Bright Horizons. You can do other things to try and attract and keep employees, such as raise wages, improve benefits. Are you doing any of those things?
Absolutely. So what we look at is we think that educating our employees is really the cornerstone of all of the things that you just mentioned. So when someone becomes more highly educated within the Bright Horizons context, they have the ability to grow their career and at the same time increase their wages. So we look at it as a foundational investment in our people so that they can have terrific careers at Bright Horizons as well as continue to secure their financial future.
What does it mean for payroll costs for the company? You are a publicly traded company, symbol BFAM, and your investors, of course, always want to make sure that, you know, you're growing profits.
Absolutely. So, again, as I mentioned, we really look at this as an investment in our people, and we believe that it will have a strong ROI, first by reinforcing our culture. In addition, we have heard there is a tremendous buzz out in the marketplace, and so it is making it easier for our recruiters to attract great people. And then finally, we believe that individuals that have gotten their education completely free through Bright Horizons will stay with us.
Talking a little bit more about the diminishing pool of talent, which EDAP is designed to address, do you also have any relations with the colleges that are training the early childhood teachers at this point to funnel them through?
Absolutely. And that has been a longstanding strategy for us, is we have very good relationships on campuses of early childhood education programs. Unfortunately, there are fewer and fewer of those programs because the demand from students to go into those programs, as I said, has been diminishing. On the other hand, we certainly are on those campuses recruiting, and now at the four curated schools, we're actually taking a more active role.
And what schools?
So we have partnered with Ashford, we've partnered with Rasmussen, Northampton, and Walden. And in each of those places, we're taking an active role in teaching classes, at getting out in a way that is even more significant than we do at other early childhood education programs.
For the employees that take advantage of this, what do they need to do in return? Do they have to commit to you for a certain amount of time after they receive their degree?
Yeah, so what we expect from them is that certainly during the time that they're studying and doing their degree, they'll be with us full time. And then all we expect from them is an 18-month commitment after they finish their studies.
Straight ahead, we'll continue with Stephen Kramer of Bright Horizons Family Solutions. We'll talk more broadly about his company and about the issue of affordable quality child care. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston News Report and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Oh, hi. Right now, I'm getting a remarkably heartfelt bear hug from Smokey Bear. Thanks, big guy. Now, if you could let me down. See, I made sure there were no low-hanging branches when I set up my campfire. And before we left, I drowned out my campfire, stirred it, drowned it out again, then made sure it was cold. Visit SmokeyBear.com to learn tips to prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 1061 Boston News Report and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. We continue our conversation with Stephen Kramer, CEO of Bright Horizons Family Solutions, about its unique program to recruit and retain talent. I asked him how many people he employs and how many participants there are in the program.
So we employ 31,000 employees globally. A little over 20,000 are here in the United States. And of those 20,000, about 15,000 are eligible because they're working directly in our centers and are focused on our early childhood education efforts.
What has been your staff turnover before? And then are you seeing an impact on retention with this new program?
So Bright Horizons enjoys a turnover that is half of the industry average. Mm-hmm. So in our industry, it's quoted that somewhere between 40% and 50% of staff turnover within our industry. And at Bright Horizons, that's typically in the low 20%. We expect that even in the current climate, that we'll be able to shrink that percentage.
You also just got, I think, yet again honored as one of the best places to work in the Boston area and in Massachusetts. I believe that was the Boston Globe?
Yes, so yeah. We were recognized as a top large employer here in the Boston area. We also were recognized as a Fortune Great Place to Work for Women, and we also were recognized by that same publication as it relates to our diversity efforts. So we are very focused on being an employee-centric organization.
Stephen Kramer, CEO of Bright Horizons, speaking with us. Given the wait lists for people to get their children into your facilities, it's also a great place for kids, I guess. So, and given the price of the for a month, $2,900, how are there that many people that are signing up even before a child is born to pay $2,900 a month?
So, again, I think the parents that we serve recognize that starting with a high-quality education for their young children is a critical foundation for that child. And so, again, are the families that we serve tend to really focus on that on behalf of their children and are most focused on the quality of the program and recognize that Bright Horizons really does offer a terrific experience for young children.
Can you tell us how you want to differentiate from other child care centers and what do you offer for that tuition?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, as this program is doing, we attract and retain the best talent. And our people are our most important asset. And ultimately, they are the ones delivering the program every day. And so we are focused on always exceeding the local and national standards for background and experience within the classroom. In addition to that, we have a tremendous proprietary emergent curriculum that really does work with the children based on their interests. And we follow their interests in the classroom to make sure that we're providing a great education. And then certainly we have environments that really are designed with a child in mind. And so I think it's those three pieces that differentiate us.
Stephen Kramer is the CEO of Bright Horizons, publicly traded company, symbol BFAM. Stock is up about 28% this year. And in your last quarterly earnings released on November 1st, you basically matched street expectations. Our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst, who covers the company, says, and you gave good forward guidance, Our analyst says that you're growing revenues, growing margins by providing backup services. Tell us about your growth strategy and what these backup services are.
Sure. So we serve, as I mentioned, across three major segments. The first is full-service childcare, which we do with employers on-site or near-site, their corporate headquarters or other locations. In addition to that, we do backup childcare. And what backup childcare does is it provides backup when there is a breakdown in a traditional care arrangement for a particular family. It is fully subsidized by the employer with the ultimate goal of allowing the employee to get to work. So if that employee, for example, if their current arrangements, whether that be a nanny or a center or a school, is either closed or sick on that particular day, they have the ability to come to a Bright Horizons center or to we can send a caregiver to their home to make sure that employee can get to work. So it's a wonderful productivity tool for our employer clients.
And then you also have the education component, additional backup services with colleges and things?
On the Ed Advisory side, what we're focused on is really two things. We're helping employers' employees who are going back to school themselves to get great support. And so we are managing the tuition assistance programs on behalf of other employers. And by the way, the EDAP program that we implemented with our own employees is really an example of us eating our own cooking. And so it was really designed internally by our Ed Advisory team to make sure that we were on the cutting edge of how we can use tuition dollars effectively. The other part of that is allowing for employees' dependents who are going to school to get great advice and support.
Speaking of eating your own cooking, we're speaking with Stephen Kramer of Bright Horizons. You've been with the company since 2006. You just became CEO on January 1st. You're the father of two young children yourself. How did that impact your perspective of where you want to take the company now?
That's a great question. So it's interesting. When I started with the company in 2006, I had no children. So I have today a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old, and it absolutely has changed my perspective. As someone who has utilized Bright Horizons services, I have a keen awareness of how important it is to deliver at the highest quality levels. Because as a parent, that's ultimately what you want. You want to be doing the best that you can for your children. And so our clients really appreciate that about Bright Horizons.
So let me just ask you, the common complaint of every parent is that childcare is just too expensive for the average parent. How can we address that?
So the way we address it at Bright Horizons is in partnership with employers. And so our goal in pioneering the concept of working directly with employers who invest in childcare, whether that be on-site or near-site, is to make it more accessible, right, because it's nearby the site, but also more affordable because our employer clients are investing alongside of Bright Horizons to bring to the families a more accessible and more affordable option.
As far as growth, where do you go from here? How many more states do you want to be in? How many more countries do you want to be in? Are you in other countries?
How many more centers do you want to open?
Yeah, so we continue to grow. you know, our center footprint based on the interests of our clients. And so the clients that we have today, we see a lot of white space in terms of those who currently do not offer on-site or near-site childcare. And so we continue to partner with them to find those solutions for their families.
Stephen Kramer of Bright Horizons Family Solutions in Watertown, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we'll speak with a woman who is taking tech giant Facebook to task about its corporate governance. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Thanks for joining us on This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. Julie Goodridge is the founder and CEO of Northstar Asset Management. She is a leading proponent of socially responsible investing. This week, she stopped by our studios to talk about Facebook. She's trying to change the corporate governance of the tech giant, and we asked her how it is going.
Well, first of all, you've got to understand that the governance at Facebook is highly screwed up. Mark Zuckerberg has 10 times the voting power on, and so does some of the other guys that helped start the firm. So he has Class B shares. He controls 51% of the shareholder vote, and the other insiders, the other guys who started the company, control another 12. So the issue at Facebook is that the Class A shares are one vote per share and Class B shares are 10 votes per share.
And what do you want? It's simple.
One vote per share.
So how's that going for you?
It's not going well, but no, I'm joking. So actually last year, every year we filed, we've gotten a slightly higher percentage of the overall vote, okay, including all of the shares voted. So this past year, we got 21% of shareholders, of the shareholder vote overall. Interestingly, that represents approximately 81% of the non-supermajority voting shareholders. So the Class A shareholders voted in favor of our resolution at 81%.
But Julie, you know when you started this, you were going to be tilting at a windmill because the only way this would pass is if Mark Zuckerberg himself voted for this.
Correct. And, you know, that's the kind of guys we are over at Northstar. It's a, you know, it's an all-female firm, or was until we hired a guy recently. But, you know, we're actually more interested in having the conversation and looking at some of the problems that have happened. And we're trying to prevent those problems from happening. For example, in 2014, we actually filed an electioneering shareholder resolution suggesting that Facebook essentially not get involved in politics.
We're speaking with Julie Goodridge. She's the founder of Northstar Asset Management with about $500 million under management. And Julie, do you feel that you have an opening here with Facebook because of all the controversies the company is facing?
No.
Okay.
I wish we did. You know, it's funny. I was doing some research this morning on kind of the way in which Facebook was actively involved in, you know, sort of the Russian meddling and all the, you know, all the mistakes they've made over the last couple of years, and realized that the degree of power that Facebook, Google, and, you know, Peter Thiel, who's a board member at Facebook, have over, you know, sort of algorithms and metrics and how information is communicated and produced, is it's pretty scary. I wish that Facebook would not have gotten involved in taking ads from a foreign power. That's actually against the law. I don't know why that hasn't come up very much, but, you know, they've made just so many
stupid mistakes. Well,
Congress
is looking into that. But let me ask you this. The fact is that Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook are not here to defend themselves. So tell us what they say about the corporate structure that the company has.
Well, they say that basically they set up the corporate structure so that Mark Zuckerberg could remain in control of the company. You know, he was the founder.
To execute his vision.
Absolutely.
For it. To make sure.
And what do I say to that?
Yeah,
you might
what's
ask.
Wrong with that?
Let me tell you what's wrong with that.
It's
if he had wanted that, the healthier way to do it would have been for Mark Zuckerberg to hold on to 51% of the shares, not 51% of the voting power, because then other shareholders would have been allowed to at least weigh in. And I think at this point, most even institutional shareholders are in favor of our resolution, which is why you know, we've got 81% of the vote for, you know, Class A shareholders.
So again, he's not here to defend himself, but he might answer that by saying he set this up so he could gift his shares to charity, which he did publicly.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because when we first filed this shareholder resolution at Facebook, the board had gotten wind of the fact that Zuckerberg wanted to, you know, give away a bunch of shares, and they were freaked out about the fact that he had so many Class B shares, and he tried to create a Class C share structure the same year we had our shareholder resolution.
Can you remind us how much you are holding of Facebook in your funds?
Yeah, it's 32,000 shares, something like that, just under $5 million.
By the way, you said you wanted Facebook to stay out of politics. You were pushing for that. You didn't foresee, of course, congressional hearings. But let me ask you another question that's related. If this were to succeed, would you consider going after other companies that do this same structure, including Google, LinkedIn, mostly tech companies?
Well, first of all, we only do it for companies that we hold in our portfolio. We do have this exact same resolution at Google. And, you know, one of the reasons I'll just point out that we didn't buy shares of Snapchat, for example, is because Snapchat doesn't give any votes to any of the public shareholders.
Thank you so much for joining us. CEO of Northstar, Julie Goodridge.
Up next, we'll talk about another tech giant, Google, and its former CEO, Eric Schmidt. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. Earlier this month, Eric Brynjolfsson, the director of the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, sat down with former Google CEO Eric Schmidt at the MIT Digital Future of Work Congress. Brynjolfsson started the conversation by asking Schmidt how technology changed his career.
I can tell you that when I started, as I guess most young people would be, none of us anticipated any of this. So it took visionaries like Steve Jobs, right, to see scale and impact of the kind that we've seen. But most of us were simply computer scientists working on interesting and hard problems. So what I learned was that you should spend your time working on network platforms that are interconnected and that scale fast. So as a simple principle, do that in life.
That worked for Google pretty well.
It worked pretty much everywhere in my entire career. Uh-huh. So if I go back to Sun, where I was for 14 years, we invented a slogan called "The network was the computer,"
right?
Which seems archaic today, but at the time was considered revolutionary. When I worked at Berkeley, I worked on the first version of networking in the form of TCP/IP networking for Unix. In every case, networks were the power source of innovation, of connectivity, and so forth. So if you think going forward, the next 50 years, what will be true in 50 years? More deeper, more powerful networks of humans and computers interacting together. And all of the consequences will come from network laws, network power, network effects of one kind or another.
Right. It's something economists are sort of now discovering, or some of us rediscovering. There's been a literature, but now they're beginning to give Nobel Prizes out to people like Jean Tirole for understanding the power of networks and two-sided networks.
What's interesting, and you did a lot of work on two-sided networks in an earlier version of yourself, the problem with networks is that people have trouble with power laws.
Yeah.
And they don't fundamentally understand how uniform and universal power laws are.
That's right.
So if you look at connectivity of cities and connectivity of telephone networks and connectivity of your friends, they all follow a certain mathematical structure. People in this audience at MIT would know this. The average human being is surprised by this. And so the political discourse always finds an edge case that looks strange relative to that produced by some form of power law connectivity.
Well, it is, and the power laws is a good description. So power laws have these long tail. There's a few winners, okay, and then a long tail. And in work I did with Guillaume Saint-Jacques, we saw that the income distribution is moving from kind of a normal or log normal distribution where there, you know, there's people on either side. If you are twice as good at, twice as dexterous, you might make twice as much money as a waiter or as a bricklayer. But with digital network economies, the winner often makes 100, 1,000, 10,000 times more than the next best person.
When I first heard this principle from a fellow named Nathan Myhrvold many, 30 years
Microsoft,
ago
yeah.
at Microsoft when he was first there, and we were talking about how the PC market share was shaping. And it was, in his view, 90%, 9%, and 0.9%. And I said, that's not true. Market shares are always 60-40. And I remember thinking, he was the first person to me
yeah.
who said, this thing has a different shape because of the nature of how the distribution networks work. In my first few years as CEO at Google, at the time, there was this notion that there was enormous amount of revenue and connectivity in the tail of the distribution, that the advertising markets were well served in the head of the tail, because they had direct salespeople and people knew the brands and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that one of the things that we were doing was we were discovering this enormous number of underserved small businesses and so forth. And that's all true. But our mentor, Hal Varian, did a study, this was again more than 15 years ago, and said, but there's a lot of revenue at the head,
mm-hmm.
right? And ultimately, the key thing about networks is that you have to study the actual slope and shape of that. It plays out in other things. So, for example, NBA basketball stars, university tuitions, university application rates. And the key business question is if you're at the very tippy top of a network distribution, you should be able to continue your strength. But if you're in one of these parts of the curve where you're getting pushed down mm-hmm. because of another network, what do you do? And that is, to me, the hardest business problem that venture capitalists and entrepreneurs face.
Well, you've been lucky or smart to mostly be up at the head of that. I mean, I know that Google wasn't always a giant company. You joined them well, it's 2001, I think you right. became the CEO there, and it was one of the small companies at the tail. So what are the strategies that work for you to help move up, and are some of those things that people in the audience could learn from?
One of the things that's worth saying is that there are better approaches, there are better engineers, there are better scientists, and if you can get a sort of a good share of them, you can make progress very quickly. The thing that was most bizarre to me joining Google was that it didn't have a normal product schedule. I had grown up in the principles that were invented here in Route 128 by Digital Equipment Corporation, Data General. The people who hired me and taught me were structured, organized engineering managers. None of that was happening. It was literally a rush, right, to what was the possible. That is now the model. So when you go,
so they were doing it right.
Well, and today,
or at least it worked out.
And today the companies that are the biggest ones have relatively informal product strategies. And a whole notion of speed, right?
Right.
So there's a book. I was going to say that our mutual friend Reid Hoffman has just published a book, which I encourage everyone to read, called Blitzscaling. And the basic argument is ignore all of the rules that you've been taught about how business works and just run super fast into a new market. And if you're confused about that, I'll give you an example outside of my own industry. Look at Tesla, right? So Tesla spends all day being criticized by everybody else, and yet they've gained share very rapidly using these techniques. There are plenty of
examples. One of the things Reid says that's a little controversial is, if you're not embarrassed by your first product, you've waited too long. Would you go that far, or were you embarrassed by the products that Google
came out with? Well, in fact,
that
was our rule.
Yeah.
And back when we could do these things, we had a rule that everything would come out in beta, because we didn't want to have to defend some of the mistakes.
You put beta, so you'd say,
and so,
don't blame us.
Yeah. People forget that Gmail came out on April 1st of, I think, 2004 in beta. And we forgot that we'd kept it in beta for so many years. But the important point about
it is... out of beta yet?
I think someone eventually took it out of its misery. But the point is that it was a signaling that that this was experimental in a really powerful way. It was part of the bargain with our users.
And this gets back to your point about networks. I mean, there's something in network theory called the preferential attachment model, that those who have much get more, and they're more likely to get additional things. So if you can get out there and start building your network...
And in fact, the way we did Gmail was interesting, is we did a seeding strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So the first people who used Gmail were employees, mm-hmm. and then we had friends of employees,
right.
and then we had friends
they
of friends.
They would send invitations,
and
you're invited to try it.
And people were constantly after me to get invitations. And that was a pretty pretty good signal to me that we had a winner here. Right. And of course, the rest is history.
So you had a couple of strategies.
So the way to say this is, the world is so competitive now that if you think you have enough time to, quote, fully finish your product, you're going to lose. Right. You have to understand the global competition. And for many reasons, it's more competitive. There's a great deal more information sharing. There's a great deal more labor movement between things. What I tell people when they start a company is you have to figure out who started it, the same company the same week, and figure out how you're going to compete with them.
One of the things you did at Google was shifted it to be a mobile-first company and with Android, and obviously that's a huge platform for everybody right now. It's big part of the internet. Most of us interact more with that through the mobile internet. But a couple of years ago, you went another step. You changed to AI first, and Google Research became Google AI. Is that different from networks? And what does it mean to be AI first? Why are you shifting in that direction?
In a relatively large company, as smart as the people are, there become these sort of orthodoxies, right? It becomes impossible to change core beliefs. So an example in my case is I would run around and look at product reviews, and I would get a demo of a mobile product, but they would show it to me on a Mac or a PC, right? And the reason was that the tools on the mobile device weren't good enough, and their in development environment was on the PC, right? And that doesn't produce the best outcome. The core rule about development is you need to the old phrase was you eat your own dog food, was the one that we used to use many years ago. And so what I ultimately said was we need to be mobile first. And mobile first meant that the best things came out on mobile, the first things came out on mobile. Now, today, that seems like duh, right? And indeed, if you look at the internet startups, they're essentially all mobile first. They typically, a simple example would be Instagram. They typically have much stronger apps on smartphones, Android.
Right, they don't even really have a desktop app.
They do, but it's not as functional. Okay. Right, or it's used for other things. Mm-hmm. Or they'd use it to treat an enterprise customer. Mm-hmm. So when Sundar came forth...
Can you say, like, I don't know if this is reported, like, what share of Google search is mobile versus desktop? Is it?
I don't know the percentage numbers, but it's grown very, very rapidly and will continue to do so. So people have moved to mobile. And so we were right about that transition. And as you said, these are general purpose technology trends. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is for the next 5 to 10 years, the vast majority of your digital experiences will be on mobile phones. And the vast majority of those will be Android, by the way. And
do you know the market share there?
Analysts report our market share is extremely high.
Thanks for listening to this week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Thanks for joining us today on this special edition of This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. Earlier this week, we spoke with Bloomberg News investing reporter and Bay State business contributor Charlie Stein about his interview with Fidelity's Abby Johnson. Janet Wu started the conversation.
Charlie, you have been in this business for over 30 years covering finance, and you just met her for the first time in person a month ago. That says something in itself. What did she tell you are her top priorities?
You know, Abby Johnson's been a little bit like kind of a Greta Garbo figure out there for a long time. You know, people know she's out there.
But she wants to be alone.
Even when she wasn't running the company, obviously she was an important figure there. And I think the book on her was always she's shy, she's press shy, she doesn't want. But, you know, in fact, she's not really at all shy. She's very smart. She's very articulate. And, you know, she made a lot of things very clear. One of the things that I found very interesting was sort of the notion is that they did these zero-fee funds basically to give Fidelity a try. Now, you'd think if you ran a company as big as Fidelity, the notion of give us a try would not really be, you know, at the top of your mind. But I think they feel in a crowded marketplace they need to compete to attract new customers, and this was a good idea. And I think clearly – you know, I don't know whose idea it was, but there was no doubt about it that she was on board.
Before we get too far into our discussion with you, what was your biggest surprise in the interview with her?
You know, I knew she was a little bit of a geek because I'd heard her speak at a tech week a while ago, but she got the most animated when the questions were technology-oriented. Like my colleague Peggy Collins asked her about cryptocurrencies because they've done some things in there, and she just took off, you know, like, wow, I was waiting for you to ask me about that, and boom, you know, it was clear she was deeply involved in the thinking, the planning, the, you know, getting in touch with the people in the cryptocurrency world. She was very engaged in the whole idea of how important technology is for Fidelity, and interestingly, just last week, last Friday, I had a story saying that they'd made the head of their new head of asset management is their chief technology officer, which is not an obvious thing to do, but it's clearly something that she puts a very high priority on.
So obviously they're going to do a lot in tech. We've actually had their virtual reality assistant, Cora, on the show in the past. I went to see Cora once.
Yeah. She's kind of like Alexa.
It's kind of cool.
For money.
But is she suggesting that they might offer, for example, ETFs for Bitcoin or something like that at some point?
It's a little unclear.
Or they just blockchain and stuff
Well, you pointed out they are currently allowing Bitcoin into Fidelity charitable funds.
So that's right. You know, I would say they're experimenting. They're experimenting. You know, I think when they first got into this, Bitcoin was a small thing. Then it went up to, you know, of course, $19,000. Today it was back down to $5,000. So, I don't know that they're betting the ranch on cryptocurrencies, but I think it was kind of emblematic of her thinking that she's opened to new things and new ideas. Just because Fidelity's always done something a certain way doesn't mean they'll always do it that way.
Isn't it the case that she tried this no fee thing as sort of a marketing ploy, a way to get some attention?
I think that's right. I think it was to get people in the door. You know, some people compared it to sort of giving out toasters at the bank. You know, they want your business. Once they have your business, there's an awful lot at Fidelity they can sell you, from active funds to advice to retirement. You know, they're in a lot of different businesses. So I think it was kind of a door buster to some extent, you know, and you know, it's been at least modestly successful so far. You know, interestingly, today I had a story about Vanguard cutting its minimum investment to qualify for the lowest fees. You have to think that's a direct response to what Fidelity did. So they're getting people's attention.
Well, Fidelity started doing these things after Vanguard passed them in amount of assets.
Right. That was
managed.
Another very interesting thing she said is, you know, we brought up the idea of these passive funds, and Fidelity historically was not very interested in these low fee passive funds. And they used to call them, they had some other name for them, Spartan funds.
Right.
She basically said, boy, that was a goof.
Bad name.
You know, and but now they've sort of jumped in with both feet. They have something like $400 billion in assets and passive products. They're not Vanguard, but they're a substantial player. She said something like, and I'm not quoting this perfectly, that if we're going to do it, we're going to be good at it, and we're going to be serious about it. And again, you know, another thing that's different about Fidelity today.
Well, it's a big shift because they've been known for these star stock pickers, but those stars aren't drawing the investors that they used to. She also talked to you about how they want to appeal to the woman investor.
Yeah, it's clearly that's an issue both she and Kathy Murphy, who we also interviewed, she's head of the retail operation. It's something they've spent a lot of time thinking about, that women, you know, control a fair amount of money. They've not really been given their due as investors. Another, I think,
was a $22 trillion
shift in assets, which is a lot of money.
And to women?
And they also got down in the nitty-gritty level of talking about redesigning their branches, which is something, you know, I'm thinking, you know, is Abby Johnson really involved in stuff like this? But it is. And, you know, they said things like they've gotten rid of the sort of screens, you know, the CNBC screens, and done a lot of things to sort of you know, I don't know what the right word is exactly, sort of.
Well, I hope they replaced the CNBC screens
with Bloomberg
screens.
I'm sure that's what
okay,
you meant.
Right. Well,
but they've clearly thought about the notion of how do you make this appealing to women? You know, the notion that you bring in the husband and the wife when you have the discussion. It's clearly something they've spent a lot of time thinking about. Again, whether it's really paid dividends, I have no idea, but it's an issue that people there have been thinking about.
Well, it was a fantastic interview. It was such a joy to read that on the terminal. Lots of information there. And Charlie Stein, thank you so much for joining us to talk about your conversation.
Straight ahead, we'll talk with Mitch Rochelle of PwC about trends in real estate. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. Earlier this month, we talked to Mitch Rochelle of PwC about its latest report on emerging trends in real estate. Tom Maroney started by asking him if the real estate sector was in for a soft landing or a crash.
Sticking with the airplane metaphor, it's a soft landing without too much turbulence. The question is, when does it land? You know, we've actually, stepping back and giving you some perspective, we've been doing this survey, Emerging Trends in Real Estate, for 40 years. So we've had the benefit of going backwards. This is the 40th anniversary that just came out. We had benefit of going backwards and looking at past cycles and seeing what leading indicators may have been in terms of the sentiment of real estate participants leading up to them. And what's interesting is real estate players are as optimistic today as they were sort of at any point prior to the crash of other cycles. In fact, the optimism today is identical to the optimism it was in 07. So
it's very interesting. Yeah, surprising.
Yeah. So their real estate investors are investors, and they I think that word's a verb and not a noun. So they tend to like to invest. But what's interesting is, and this is one of our takeaways, is there's way more discipline today around real estate finance and capital investment than there was leading into any prior cycle. So if you want to get a loan, it's still hard to get a loan, and there's still underwriting standards that are in place that are considerably more difficult than they were. And I just describe that as somebody buying a house or somebody building a, you know, $400 million office tower. So that's the thing that's going to, if it does land, get it to land very gradually.
The Boston real estate market comes in seventh now, jumping three spots among the hottest real estate markets. So how does that factor into your soft landing theory? There's still room to grow in Boston, I guess.
Yeah, no question. And I'm going to sort of unpack that a couple of different ways. If you look at who's in the top 10, most of them are smaller non-gateway cities. So Boston is unique, and Brooklyn is number two, which is unique in that it's more of a big city gateway market. What's interesting about Boston is why it's the net result of, and we saw this in other cities, so I'm making the parallel, it's the net result of long-term planning and infrastructure investment that pays off in maybe at the end of a subsequent generation. So, I mean, right where the studio is, we could look out the window and see when I was in college at Bentley a long time ago, there was two restaurants out there, and that was it, right? And
Clam Flats, really.
No Name Seafood was out there, and that was nothing else. And now there's as much as $40 billion worth of real estate investment either done or planned to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's what has Boston in the top 10. It's that there's this long-term planning infrastructure. But the secret sauce across all 10 of them is where young people want to work and where young people come from education-wise, because we have a skilled labor shortage in this country. And when kids graduate from college and they can find work in a city, maybe where they went to school or maybe where they'd like to be, they tend to stay there. Employers chase them because employers are chasing workers, not the other way around. So we've got a virtuous cycle. And that's the story across virtually all 10 of the cities in the top 10. And Boston's no exception.
Mitch Rochelle is with PwC. We're talking about the 40th anniversary edition of Emerging Trends in Real Estate. Mitch, a question we deal with a lot on this program is climate change, the rising sea level in Boston Harbor. You sparked this from your last comment, how well Boston's doing. I often ask people like the mayor, will this come to an end? Will rising sea levels really become a factor soon? Scientists are telling us the sea's going up quicker than anybody thought. How does this impact what you're talking about.
What's interesting, Tom, is real estate investors have, by and large, over time, ignored environmental factors. So even though there was a push for LEED certification in buildings and green buildings, real estate investors sort of rejected that the way Americans rejected the metric system. Like, we don't want to hear about it. But what happened is the marketplace started demanding it, and tenants wouldn't be in a building unless it was a certain level of LEED certification, and that sort of forced the real estate industry to catch up. I think the same is going to hold true for environmental sensitivity in development over time. It obviously costs more money to develop things that are more environmentally sensitive. That's, you know, just sort of basic economics. But if the marketplace is forcing that to happen in terms of who will buy units or who will rent space, so I think the real estate industry is playing catch up really, really quickly. Going back to the comment I made about infrastructure to tie them together, when the public sector and the private sector find a way to work together, and when the public sector doesn't politicize it, meaning this is an agenda of this administration, but when the next administration shows up, they don't care about it anymore. If you can have something that transcends multiple generations, then it tends to work. And I'll give you a case study in that. Tampa, Florida, which is 10 in our rankings, several mayors ago looked at the river as being sort of a mess, and saw San Antonio and how they created a riverwalk and said, I wonder if we could do that here. That was a pet project of one mayor that got handed to the next mayor, that got handed to the next mayor, switching political parties, and ultimately it got done. And obviously the city council turned over. But when you commit to something long term, now look at Tampa. It's vibrant. People living downtown, they're attracting millennials, they're attracting retiring baby boomers who want to live downtown. So what do? They cleaned up an environmental sore spot in terms of the river and dealt with some of the environmental issues of water flow and water containment. So if you get the public sector and private sector to align their interests and work together, big thumbs up, it can work.
The other infrastructure issue going forward has got to be transportation.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm a New Yorker. I'm just like grinning in a weird way. Yeah. there's no, and that's a big, Austin, Texas is a perfect example. What we hear over and over and over again is how awful the traffic is in Austin. Well, no surprise, their population is growing faster than any other city in the United States, and they have to figure out a way to address it. And when people tell me that ride sharing is the solution to traffic problems because you can carpool, I don't think that that's a systemic solution.
Well, there's
solution.
Another term here. We call it peak tolling. So you charge people more at the rush hour. Maybe that's, you feel the same way about that.
Well, Washington, D.C. has that model, too. In between Broward County and Dade County in Florida, they have that model. The problem with that is, and it's sort of ripped out of the book Freakonomics, which is if the unintended consequence of something is you'll pay more, you'll find that people are willing to pay for that convenience. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are doing what you wanted them to, which is to drive at a different time. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'll drive during rush hour. It's just going to cost me four times more.
Ultimately, the answer is what? More infrastructure.
More infrastructure.
Mitch Rochelle with PwC. Thanks for your insights.
Thanks today. Both for having me on.
Coming up, you'll hear from a kidpreneur who is building his own business at just 12 years old. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
Thanks for joining us on This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. We talk to a lot of entrepreneurs on our show, but this week we had a conversation with the youngest one yet, 12-year-old Owen Samoes of Squid Flip in New Hampshire. I started by asking this kidpreneur what he makes.
Well, I usually make furniture, but lately I've been making my own paint.
How did you get inspired to do this?
Well, there's a show on television named Flea Market Flip, where there's two teams. You know, they buy furniture and they redo it and sell it. I thought it was a really interesting idea. I said, hey, why can't you turn that into a business, you know?
So this paint is called Squid Flip? Squid Ink?
Yes.
Tell us more.
The paint's called Squid Ink. It's It's a type of chalked paint, and it's basically just a paint that really has a very flat, smooth finish on it, but it's usually incredibly expensive, so I've been trying my best to make a easier alternative so anybody can buy the paint.
Oh, and I want to know more about how you kind of incorporated Flea Market Flip into your business. Do you do the flip yourself in a way, the way the people on the show would do, where they fix up the stuff and then sell it? Is that how it works?
Yes.
So what are you good at? What kinds of things do you do?
One of the things I like to make is suitcase tables where you put legs onto suitcases. I usually paint something, but, yeah, I put legs on things. I have this, like, metal tray, and I put rocks and fake succulents, put a piece of glass over and a crate under it, and turned it into a coffee table.
I went on your website. Some of your pieces are unique and beautiful. So he takes this suitcase, flips it on its side, adds some legs, and it makes a really beautiful table. Well, and how do you find time to do this and school?
I usually just do it after school on the weekends, and sometimes I go to shows like around the summertime when I don't have any school.
How's business?
Lately, it's been pretty good. I was just on Good Morning America. That brought a lot of business.
So how much? Give us some idea of business. Are you selling thousands of dollars worth of stuff or hundreds of dollars worth of your products or what?
I would say maybe hundreds of dollars. I think it's not really in the thousands, maybe like 1,000. But like, I don't make that much money, but I don't really think it's about the money. It's just, you know, the giving people furniture.
What would you sell, for example, what would you charge for one of your suitcase coffee tables?
Usually around $60, $70, sometimes even $80.
And then you've had to buy the raw materials, the old suitcase and whatnot, so you do make a profit?
Yes.
We're speaking with Owen Samoz, and he is what they call a kidpreneur. And for more on this idea of kids who have their own businesses, we're bringing in Owen's dad, Ziams. And so, Ziams, tell us about kidpreneurship.
Well, in our case, it was more of an accident. Owen and his mom were furnishing a vacation rental house that we bought in Maine. And so they worked together to buy affordable furniture and then transform it into something really special. And I think that's how you got the bug, right, Owen, to start flipping furniture. And so, I think every kid probably follows his or her own path to being a kidpreneur. I think in your case, it was that opportunity to design and create furniture affordably for this house.
Yeah. Now, Jaime, a lot of kids say to their parents, I want to do this or that, and then they don't follow through. When he said he wanted to build a company, did you believe him at first?
You know, most 12-year-olds are playing video games and watching YouTube. But when he said he wanted to do it, I thought that was a great idea. He's an amazing kid, and it certainly has given him a lot of definition in his life. I'm very proud. And I'm impressed by how much people have been interested in what he's doing, because it's pretty cool.
Owen, does this make you think that maybe you want to major in business when you go on to college later, or, you know, to really take the entrepreneurship all the way as an adult?
Yeah, I probably would. Maybe not just like business and be something similar to it, but definitely I want to keep doing this because I have so much fun doing it.
Ziams, how have you and Owen's mom helped him with the business? Did you is it in an LLC, for example, or what?
So I don't know if the income levels yet to the point that we have to form an LLC, but I think his mom gave him a lot of the ideas and got him started on materials and projects. She took him to Brimfield here in Massachusetts. They've been now twice. I had in the building where our company is, the downstairs was empty. So he's been renting that out for the last couple summers as his showroom. And obviously we've encouraged him and taken him to shows and helped him set up partnerships to do pop-up stores.
All right. That leads into the next question. Owen, what do you want to do with your company? Where do you see yourself going from here?
I could see myself making it pretty, like, U.S.-wide, and lately I've been, like, hoping maybe just, like, for, like, a new place for Squid Flip that's a little bit, you know, closer to, like, the part of Concord that more people come on. But I think through the business, I want it to be, like, maybe just in New England, you know, have it actually be, like, a whole store and try my best to make everything handmade and handcrafted.
Owen Samoz, a kidpreneur from Concord, New Hampshire. Thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
Up next, the CEO of Coalesce AI. You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
You're listening to This Week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. Last week, our C-suite guest was Greg Wolf of Coalesce AI, a company that is working in fintech. I started by quoting a line from his website. Greg, your website says that you are trying to shrink the haystack. What does that mean?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. And Jana, great to be here tonight. So what we find with artificial intelligence, as you say, is there's a lot of hype and excitement around the space and a lot of potential. And what we see, and in fact, some of our customers see this as the fourth wave after cloud, mobile, and social. So this could be the next transformative technology, especially in financial services. Now, when you look at the world of AI, we like to kind of carve the AI pyramid, if you will, into two different layers. At the top of the pyramid, there's automating the thinking. So AI is a technology that allows folks to automate the way they do things. And automating the thinking is around being able to get insights from huge amounts, copious amounts of data for people. We think it's a little early for that type of technology. We don't know from a technology perspective and also from a societal perspective whether people are willing to come into work and have the computer tell them what to do. But where we're finding a lot of opportunity in the world of financial services is automating the doing, rather using the AI to automate a lot of the repetitive, tedious, mundane tasks that happen in financial services every day.
Can you give us some examples of those mundane tasks?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have some banking customers who receive over 50,000 emails a day, and they have 300 customer service. This one customer has 300 customer service reps who literally have to touch every one of those emails and respond to them. And what we were able to do is through our application, their business users, their customer service reps, were able to teach the system to identify around 10 different inquiries that are commonly coming through the channels from their customers. Things like, I can't find my password, I lost my password, how do I get online, I've lost my credit card. And what the AI was able to do was able to identify and recognize those kinds of mundane queries so that and automate the responses to those, either going to the password system and getting a reset or possibly queuing up a reply template like somebody who may be asking for interest in a new mortgage product, and thereby take the tedious mundane work away from the customer service reps and be left with more of the interpretive analysis work that, frankly, people are much better at.
We're speaking with Greg Wolf, the CEO and founder of Coalesce AI, for this week's C-suite conversation. And would the other party know that that was artificial intelligence sending it to them? And would it matter?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think one of the things that we're able to do is, as Peter said, shrinking the haystack. You know, a lot of would the other party know? I don't think so. In fact, they would benefit from it. So, for instance, our product runs behind the scenes. It's not customer interfacing. It's really helping the financial services firm deliver better service, faster service, faster capabilities to reply to and serve and give their customers new product and offerings. So essentially, the customer, the consumer at the end of the day, is not actually aware of the fact that the AI is enabling the customer service rep in that circumstance to provide a more of a value-added, faster service.
Tell us a little bit more about the company then. How big are you now? How many customers do you have? Go ahead and share sales and revenue and profits with us, if you wish.
Sure. Well, we're a private company, and we have, we're still closely held, so we tend not to disclose that kind of information. But essentially, we're based in Boston. We're fortunate enough to participate in the DCU FinTech Innovation Center, which was a great launching place for us. In fact, we actually did a pivot last year. We started out when we launched the product and the company at the beginning of last year. We were originally focused on using AI to automate investment research, specifically private market investment research. And we actually found that that wasn't a great area for our type of technology because it's a very competitive space. And being able to kind of get alpha and from a machine is kind of tricky. But instead, what we found was that working with large financial organizations, that there was a terrible demand for improvements and increases in the way they do their operational side of things. So we focused more on the middle and the back office. And DCU was actually a terrific place for us to do that because being a bank, they gave us the opportunity to understand some of those use cases. And luckily, since then, we've been able to flourish.
So is DCU a customer?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. We have a number of projects that we actually implemented at DCU.
So if you can't be specific on the number of your sales, can you be at least tell us about how the sales have grown by percentage?
Yeah, absolutely. So last year when we launched the product, we focused on the investment analysis side of things. And once we pivoted and started to get some real traction with our message and finding where the product best fits in the market, I'm happy to say that by the end of this year, we're expecting a 5x increase in our revenue for the year, so about 500% growth this year.
As we were sitting down, you told us that you did an angel round, and then you self-funded the initial development. Do you think you can continue to do that, or at some point will you need to take in more outside money? Because this is a very competitive space.
Without a doubt, and I think it would be foolish to not take advantage of the opportunity in the market leadership position that we have been able to establish through that angel round and through some of our initial implementations and goals. Actually, we received a couple of term sheets last year from institutional investors, but I think that's kind of a double-edged sword. And we didn't take those term sheets. Instead, we used some self-funding and angel money to really find that pivot point and identify where the true opportunity was. And now that we've been able to do that, we certainly are interested in hitting certain milestones and metrics to go out with a more significant institutional run at the beginning of next year.
Peter was asking, this is a company that you spun out of another company that you started.
That is correct. Yeah, my previous company is called Vantage Software, which I founded and ran for about 15 years. And that company was focused on the alternative investment market. So our customers in that space are private equity, venture, and real estate firms who manage over $1 trillion in alternatives. And when we had this dream about AI, we saw it coming. We saw Watson and Siri and self-driving cars, and we thought, wow, this would be great technology to use in that business. So that gave us the impetus and some of the initial funding, obviously, to kind of create the product and then spin it out into Coalesce at the beginning of last year.
So it would seem to me that trying to help financial firms manage mundane tasks to shrink the haystack would be something that a lot of other companies would be doing too. Do you have competitors, or was this a eureka moment and nobody else is doing it, or what?
Yeah, there's a lot of competition in the space, and the way we differentiate ourselves is we come at it from a business user's perspective. So when we built out the platform, we actually created a technology called UDML, user-defined machine learning. We find there's kind of a gap between the business users and the data scientist.
And how big of a market is this, do you think?
Well, we've done some analysis. I mean, there's a lot of stats floating around. McKinsey came out with a report recently where they said that around 65 to 69% of data collection and processing in financial services can be automated by current technology. So that translates into, depending on how you slice it, more than $150 billion opportunity.
How much of that have you got so far? are you doing over $1 million in revenue at this point?
Yeah, we're close to that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
You said this was really a $150 billion space. My question to you, this is critical given all the fee compression happening within financial services.
Yeah, Jenna, without a doubt, financial services are under a lot of pressure, especially in asset management. And being able to automate and improve their operations and the way they do business is a critical element of what they do. So our customers are very interested in using this technology to do more faster. You know, interestingly, there are concerns about job displacement, right? Everybody's afraid that the computers are going to come in, the robots, and take people's jobs. But what we're actually finding is that by empowering the business users to do their job better, faster, more thoroughly, and we're actually starting to see our customers use this technology not so much as a means to get to cut down on their staffing, but actually to grow their operations because their staff are able to be so much more valuable in terms of doing more value-added tasks and being much more efficient at it.
Greg Wolf, you're not from here.
Oh, you detected an accent.
Yeah. Where are you from? Tell us your story.
So I'm originally from South Africa and came to Boston about 25 years ago. And
it was when you said chowder.
Yeah.
No, continue.
Definitely. So my entry point actually was in through PricewaterhouseCoopers in Boston, and been here ever since. Worked on 160 Federal Avenue for a while, Federal Street. So, you know, when I started out as a kid, I actually, interestingly, recently I went back and I looked at my academic transcript for some reason, and I remembered that I'd actually studied computer science, math, and linguistics as a kid, which was kind of an unusual combination. And I understand now, you know, and then I did a degree in finance, and as I said, I came through into the USA via PwC in Boston. But in a way, the problem is I was 20 years too early, because these days there's a whole discipline of AI called natural language processing, and you can do a PhD in a degree in that. But at the time, 20-something years ago, you know, nobody had ever heard of that. But it's really the kind of the combination of the finance and the technology that allows us to kind of deliver value for our customers.
So how do you pivot from working at one of the largest companies in the world to doing startups?
Well, I was very fortunate to work at PwC. Obviously, it was a great opportunity to learn business culture and to learn how things are done here and make some terrific networking connections. And that's how actually I started my prior company, working through some clients of PwC that I had audited in the private equity and venture space. And that's how it gave me the opportunity and the idea to work with them and figure out a solution that could help them for my prior company.
Greg Wolf, founder and CEO of fintech company Coalesce AI. Well, thanks for listening to this week on Bloomberg Bay State Business. I'm Peter Barnes. This is Bloomberg Bay State Business on 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.